Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
Welcome to another edition of the People I Sort of Know podcast. Today, we're going to talk with Hogan Gidley. Hogan's been a friend of mine for a while now, several years. He worked in the White House under Donald Trump as a deputy press secretary. He was also the communications director for Trump's reelection campaign in 2020. He's been on multiple other presidential campaigns throughout the years in communications. But today, we're not going to talk a lot about or really talk about any specific political issues. That's not what today's podcast is. We're going to talk to Hogan about a lot of things. We're going to talk about just his ability to keep schedules, something that I've been working on in my life as far as discipline to working out, eating correctly. Hogan's been excellent at that for more than two decades with a very hectic lifestyle, very hectic career, I guess I should say, between not knowing what's coming next, especially during his time in the White House. So we're going to talk about those things. We're going to get into some different things involved with his job, things as far as presidential campaigns, what those are like. We're getting into some topics as far as speaking for the country in some different ways, the gravity that comes with that. A lot of stuff coming up with Hogan today. Again, he's an Ole Miss grad, played tennis at Ole Miss. I think you'll enjoy it. Just hang in there with us here for a little while. It's a little longer episode than I typically do, but we kind of got going and just kept talking. So, again, a lot of stuff coming up here on the show today. Hogan gives us a ton of time, so let's jump into it now. Here is Hogan Gidley on the People I Sort of Know podcast. Hogan Gidley now joining us, my friend, Ole Miss grad, been in the White House, now doing all sorts of things. Hogan, I've been wanting to do this for a while. I appreciate it, and it's not – I've had several people ask me this because I've been talking a ton about – I don't know, time management, trying to get in a little better shape, all that January stuff. And I'll tell you, it's not January, though. It's not about New Year's resolutions. And you're going to look at me and call me a young tyke and laugh at me here. But I turned 40 at the end of the year. And I'm kind of like, you know what? I've got like a year here. For some reason, 40 is this arbitrary number in my head. And I go, I kind of want to knock out these things. I want to accomplish these things. And when I turn 40, I want to feel better about these three or four parts of my life for some reason. I'm not going through a crisis or anything, but I did kind of see that as this splice point and said, okay, it's kind of time to get my stuff together a little bit.
Get your stuff together how?
I don't know. Like I said, just get in a little better shape. I mean, there's some things, you know, business-wise, sure. Personally, just kind of stuff. Okay. Like I'm a procrastinator, Hogan. I'm a procrastinator. I admit it. And I've got to get out of that. I've got to actually go do some of these things that I'm constantly talking about or writing down.
Me too. I understand that. There's a book someone wants me to write. I've been kind of working with someone on that and trying to figure out how that works. And I've kind of been blowing it off. And I really kind of took some earnest steps to do that this year. And then also talking to some other folks about some different projects out there outside the political realm, more in the corporate realm. And for various reasons, that's been difficult up until this point. So I understand what you're trying to do. You're trying to figure a few things out. I'm not going to call you that young at 40. And look, it's not as arbitrary as you think it is. Things start to take a different turn at 40, and they're not up. You know what I mean? Everything's kind of on a downward tick at that point.
Yeah, well, you know, what is intriguing me, and you and I have been friends for several years now, is you've had a lot of jobs that are definitely not 9 to 5, all sorts of hours, all sorts of travel. yet you find a lot of ways to take care of yourself. And I mean that in the utmost compliment from that standpoint. I know when I was in D.C. with you a few years ago, you talked about, you know, getting your workouts in, and then you would call me leaving the White House at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock Eastern time, and all those different things. And with your schedules, that I guess I'll start with this is, when's the last time you actually had just this 9 to 5 where you even could plan and know what your day is like? I mean, I would assume that even now, for the most part, you don't necessarily know what's coming every day, do you?
Yeah, not every day. Things are a whole lot slower than the White House. I'm sure that won't shock you to any degree. You know, because in that building, you know, if something happens around the globe, you've got to know about it. So if a rocket's fired off at 2 in the morning, you're the one who gets the call to have the conversation. Sometimes you have to brief the president, not from a military standpoint, because he has military people do that, from a media standpoint, which is my area of expertise. Yeah, I think, you know, everybody's different. Everybody's different. I love when people will say, what's your routine? Tell me your routine. And I'll tell them what I eat, how I do things. But it's always funny. It's kind of like, you know what you got to do. You eat less and you work out more. I mean, I don't, it's not, here's a news flash. You know how it's, there are some of those books that say like a smart thing a Republican said or a smart thing a Democrat said, just blank, you know, it's like, I want to say, you know, fix all of your weight problems. You open up, it's like eat less. And that's the whole book. Like it just says that on every page. Look, again, you got to find something that works for you, Chase. And I'm no health expert by any stretch. I would say my meals have pretty much been the same for the last 25 years. So I'm not too concerned about, you know, variety, keeping it different in large part because of my work. It dictates how I have to eat and prepare. But I remember when I was working for Mike Huckabee when he was governor. So I've known Sarah Sanders since she was 19 before I worked with her in the White House and other places. So got to go over there for her inauguration, which was a blast. But, you know, Mike, and I have to say Mike now, because if I say Governor Huckabee, you'll be confused as to which governor.
Sure.
Mike asked me one time, he said, don't you ever cheat? And I said, yeah, but I'm not going to cheat at the Fordyce Rotary Club where it's chicken fried steak and whatever. If I'm going to cheat, it's going to be a meal that I want. It's going to be a filet. It's going to be, you know, a good carb. It's going to be some good vegetables with a dressing. It's going to be a dessert of some kind. I think that's important. If you're going to do it. And I'll tell you a good follow, whether you love him or hate him, The Rock on Instagram, when he does cheat days, my gosh, mm-hmm. that dude can cheat. And now again, he puts in all the work, you know, he makes billions of dollars to do it. So I understand. But I've always been someone who prepares my meals because I eat every 2 hours or so. So I don't want work to dictate when I can and can't eat. I don't want travel to dictate when I can and can't eat. So, and it's not always the best stuff. It may be canned chicken, not chicken breast I've made. But, you know, if you're on the road in Iowa and it's, you know, 200 degrees below zero, as it often is, and you're driving around, I bring a little blue cooler and I have my little meals in there. I have my protein shakes in there. And it was funny because Governor Huckabee, when he was heavy, used to make fun of me and whatever. And then he goes to the doctor because he wants to lose weight. And the doctor says, hey, you need to eat every 2 hours and bring like chicken breasts in a bag in a cooler every day. And I was like, thank you. Exactly. I think everybody's different. Their bodies are all different as well. Obviously, I'm a morning workout guy because if I don't do it in the morning, I won't do it. Now, I take it to extremes sometimes. So if I'm on the campaign trail, for example, I go to a 24-hour fitness. If we're leaving at 5 a.m., sometimes I'll go to the gym at 2:30 in the morning or 3. That sounds crazy because it is. But I know if I don't get it in, it's the only time I have a chance to expend that energy and kind of break that monotony of pressure that's on me in any given day. That's just kind of my release. And I think you've heard that many times from other people who work out and do certain things. But I mean, look, I think for me, I have a workout I like to do and I have it all structured and I kind of pop along in those ways. I will say I take a week off every 3 months. So at the end of every third month, I take a week off. Don't do abs, don't do running or walking or anything. Because I think it's good for someone at our ages, Chase.
Yeah.
To have give your bones and your joints a chance to kind of relax and, you know, just kind of replenish there. But that's kind of, we can talk specifics if you want to, but that's kind of my mentality on it.
When you've been doing it so long, you mentioned this 25 years, a lot of similar meals and things along those lines, that's sort of what I've been, I don't know if studying is the right word. I've always read, because I think one of the things I did is I caught myself reading books or watching videos or doing things, but not actually implementing them. And I'm like, why are you spending so much time reading and learning all this? And then you're not actually doing it in your life. You're an idiot right now when you're doing that. But the point is, and this goes for anything, this doesn't have to be about weight loss or fitness. This is just about part of your daily routine in ways that are being productive for you, whatever that is. That could be journaling. That could be reading. That could be working in the morning. That could be anything. But the point is, you know, you can't necessarily just be motivated by something, because as soon as you take a day off, it's easy for that to become 4 days off. It's that you've got to do it so long that it's a non-negotiable. And I think that's what I am trying to get to with several other parts, not necessarily weight loss or fitness or anything else, but just in general. And that's what I find fascinating. You've done this for so long that you don't even have to think about it. You just look at your schedule for a day and you know, okay, well, this is at 5 a.m., this is at 6 a.m. Well, okay, that means 3 a.m. I mean, it's just a part of it. And that's not something you're willing to skip on at this point.
Right. And I go out of my way to find, if I'm traveling, to find a gym. I go around and drive around and find it. How far is it from the house? Can I get in there before hours? Do I have to have a code key or a card key to get in, or some type of fob? I think about those things because I know I need that part. But you look, you're right. I think, and one of the things for this new year I wanted to make sure I did was get up in the morning and after the gym, sometimes I go back to bed for 30 minutes. Sometimes I start reading, do what I need to do throughout the day. But I kind of made a checklist for myself in the morning in this new year to start reading certain publications I need to read for my job to make sure I go through those. And I go through them on Twitter or whatever, but I'm making myself sit down, do that. I have a devotion I do, Charles Spurgeon devotion, morning and evening. So I start with that, and then I start going through the different news outlets. So I have a 45-minute window there that I can do all those things to prep, and it gives me some knowledge for the day in my work. It also prepares me for upcoming issues we may face from a media standpoint, a political standpoint. And, you know, I think if I can start that by getting those things out of the way, then it just kind of frees me up. Look, when I'm done with work at the end of the day, I'm done. I'm not going to work out. Some people love at night and you want to go. Another part of this is, and this is going to something I think you and your counterpart there on your other podcast would appreciate. I don't like a lot of people around when I'm working out or in general. That's fine too. Nah, I like people. Okay. But I don't like to wait on equipment or, you know, so if I go at night, it's a lot of people. And I have to wait, and it throws my rhythm off and my routine off, and I'm resting too long, or I'm having to do things too fast because I don't want to, get in someone else's way. And so for me, that's why it's so early. I mean, it's a 5:15 wake up call every day. And I just start my day that way. And so I think, like you said, the motivation needs to be there. Sure. The results you want need to be something you have in your mind, but also it's just a commitment to do it a certain way and to stick to that commitment. And it means you may have to change things on the day before, meaning I can't stay up till 11 o'clock. I can, but getting up for the gym is difficult. I have to start thinking about bed around 9 o'clock, 9:30. And I'm winding down 10:15. If I'm not asleep by then, I know the next day is going to be difficult. So you have to start to shift your life in a way that prepares, you know, one step leads to the next, right? You can't just wake up at 5 if you're used to going to bed at midnight. It's going to be a hard thing for someone like, you know, for someone who doesn't do that to do, obviously.
What made you start meal prepping and that kind of stuff at 20 years old? I mean, what went into it at that point?
Well, I played tennis at Ole Miss. So, you know, most people don't have to worry about weight at 18. But I'll tell you this, I sure didn't have to worry about it when I was practicing 4 and 5 hours a day playing tennis. So in my sophomore year, I wasn't going to be a pro tennis player. I started getting scholarship money for journalism and things like that. So I thought, let's focus on a career. Who knows? I'm not going to go to the Australian Open at the end of the year. So let's focus on actually what can make me money. And everyone kind of jokes about the freshman 15. And I had a lot of fraternity brothers who gained 15, if not more. Mm-hmm. And so I thought to myself, now how I want to gain weight, but I want to gain it the right way. So, you know, I joined a gym there in Oxford that wasn't, I couldn't go to the athletic center or the training center anymore for tennis. And I just, what I would look at was do protein shakes, do meal prep. And so my first job, this is going to be so sad. My first job in journalism, it's that great joke that what's the difference between a large pizza and a journalist? A large pizza can feed a family of three. And my first job in TV, I made $15,500 a year. So I didn't have a lot of food around. I couldn't do that. I got my first raise to $20,000 after like 6 months. So then I could afford food. And I started realizing, wait a minute, I need to pound on chicken breasts. I need to do, you know, whatever. So I started figuring out a meal plan that made sense to me. And I don't know where I even came up with it. Like, I was thinking about this the other day. And when you called about potentially having this conversation, I thought, where did I even come up with that? I don't know. It just seemed like eating every couple of hours made sense, keeping your metabolism going, doing it first thing in the morning. And so I thought, all right, I'll do carbs before I go to the gym because you need carbs to work out. So I thought some kind of cereal that's carb heavy, low, you know, no non-fat milk or skim or 1% or 2, whatever. And then I was like, all right, then I need to add something after that. So I got to have a protein shake and then like a sandwich. And I thought, well, if I just eat protein, your body's going to eat that protein and it's going to go nowhere. So I need a carb. So maybe I make it a sandwich, but I don't want thick bread. So I got to get fine. So like, I just started thinking about these things, what seemed to me logical at the time. And now it's just whatever. I pack a meal to go. My office isn't just but a few blocks away, but I take all my meals all day because if I get stuck in a meeting, I'm going to pull out some yogurt and eat it. I'm going to pull out, you know, a sandwich. I'm going to pull out a protein shake, whatever. So I have it with me. I don't know. I wanted to gain weight, but I didn't want to gain it the wrong way because I was always a skinny kid. Like, I think my weigh-in for SEC when I first got to college to weigh in for tennis, I think it was like 145, something like that, 147. I think could have been one less than that. And then when I left college, I weighed 177, 180 with like 8.5% body fat. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that to say, look at me. I'm just saying like, I knew I could gain weight. I just wanted to do it in a way that made sense. And so when I left college, I just wanted to keep that up. And so when I would travel, again, I get very, you know, hangry is a real thing. And I get real hangry in a hurry. And so I was like, all right, I'm just going to have to start taking my meals to work because I want to be able to eat when I want to eat. I don't want to have to stop work to go find food. I don't want to stop work and get out of a flow if I'm in something. I just want to be able to pick it up, you know, a piece of chicken breast out of a bag and just keep working on what I'm doing. I don't know. It's just weird. That's just kind of how it all happened, I'd say.
What do you weigh now?
I weighed yesterday at 178.
Okay.
So I don't think I really gained or lost a pound in 25 years. I know we were talking about our good friends at Blue Delta Denim who are happy to – they can sponsor me anytime they want to. But it's a good product if you don't gain or lose weight. I think I'd be a good candidate for them because I just they do make great jeans. But – I don't plan to fluctuate that much. I'll tell you one thing too, because everyone always asks me, do I drink? I don't drink during the week. Now Friday, Saturday, you better back up. No, I'm kidding. But I'm saying like Friday night and Saturday, I drink. I try not to drink on Sunday. And that's one thing I really wish I didn't do now. But DC is such a NFL town, right? It's a party town. It's a brunch town. So Sundays are kind of big here. I didn't realize that when I moved here. But still, it's just moderation. And I'm not drinking things that would be overly sugar, overly caloric, So that's another thing.
Well, and I'll tell you, I mean, you hit it because you're so regimented. If you drink during the week, it's not necessarily even just getting the buzz or whatever at night, isn't it? It screws up your sleep so much. I mean, that's what I've learned with myself. I mean, I've started, everybody makes fun of me because I've got fitness trackers all over and all this stuff, but I'm always into analytics and stuff. I mean, it's stupid. I mean, I get it. But what I have learned is that even one drink, even if it's at 6:30, 6 o'clock, my sleep goes to hell. It completely kind of wrecks my sleep differently. I do not stay asleep. My body temperature comes up a little bit. I don't know if I'm not handling the alcohol. I don't know. It's not like I'm drinking like margaritas or sugary things, but I don't know if I'm not handling the sugars I don't know what it is chemically, but I have gotten to the point where at home, like if I go to dinner or something, sure, I'll have a drink. I do not pour alcohol at home at all. I mean, I get made fun of on the podcast all the time because we'll do our Thursday night shows or our post-game shows, and I've got like a LaCroix or some sort of seltzer water or something because I don't drink at home at all. I've even got to the point where I will take a bourbon, pour it over ice, and I'll twirl it, and I'll notice I never actually take a sip. It's like I just get the ritual of taking the glass and rolling it around and letting that calm the nerves or whatever. But it has made an incredible impact in a positive way on my sleep to cut out alcohol for the most part. I mean, I just do not handle it very well.
Yeah, and again, I think everybody's different. I don't know I don't know if it does something to me, bad or good necessarily. I mean, I've had bad night sleep after I've had cocktails. Don't get me wrong, but also for me here in DC, it was like you have one too many drinks, and then Russia fires off a nuclear weapon. You're going to have a tough time when the Situation Room calls to tell you about it to come up to the White House. So I thought, not the smartest thing to do to, you know, have too many cocktails during the week. But I'd not had drinks during the week for a very, very, very long time. That's very rare for me if I do it. And, you know, I had drinks like I went to Sarah's inauguration in Arkansas, as I mentioned, Sarah Sanders, who's the governor of Arkansas now. I had drinks those nights. I mean, that's a Tuesday and a Wednesday. I would never drink normally, but I thought, all right, so then I didn't drink on Friday night, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of traded off there.
Not necessarily fitness or our current conversation, but just in general, when you were in the White House and any of the levels that you were for those couple of years, 3 years, whatever it was, your day is typically not going to be known. I mean, you know when you're going to work that morning for the most part, but I would assume that everything was sort of hell. What would it take? You get off at, say, 8, 9 o'clock the night before. What is the preparation for the next day? What does that look like as far as going to work, having a plan, knowing when meetings are, while also knowing that at any moment you might be on this news network or this happened or whatnot? How do you sort of handle that lack of preparation possibilities?
You know, have you ever seen The West Wing?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I laugh, but it is kind of real. The like walking and having like a quick meeting and a walk, and then you turn to another room and there's another quick meeting and a walk, and then another quick meeting, and you sit down for 3 hours and have some long, ridiculous meeting, and you get up and you walk on the way. And it's really interesting because it was just such a nonstop barrage. And I don't mean because I was in the press office, it's not just the meetings or the conversations, but you don't know what's going to happen. And you remember early on in the administration, it was Twitter. He would get up and tweet something early. And then my whole day, we had a whole day planned to worry about infrastructure. It was a kind of running joke, infrastructure week. And we wouldn't talk about infrastructure the whole week because he'd get up and tweet something and then that was it. And early on when I got there, October of 2017, I remember every morning, and I was the first one there because I get up, go to the gym, and I like to do things when there are a lot of people around because when everybody gets there, then my day gets kind of thrown off kilter. But they would come rushing in and be like, he tweeted this. What does this mean? What does this mean? I can't believe. And then after like a year, he would tweet things and no one would come in my office anymore to ask questions about it. They were just like, all right, well, I guess this is what we're doing today. Different anecdote, different story. But the preparation, I wouldn't say is something you can necessarily be ready for in the sense that it's always going to be something new every day because, like I said, it's not just what we do as America. It's what other countries are doing that affects our day, and we have no idea of knowing that. But, I mean, you know, you have your meeting schedule, and it's supposed to be this and supposed to be that, and you're prepared for it. And when you get home at 9 o'clock, I remember I used to laugh and tell people, you know, I was there at 7:30 in the morning probably. And then I remember my schedule's opposite of Trump's. So Donald Trump would work till, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night in the Oval. But he wouldn't come in till later in the day. He was always working from the residence, but still. But I remember telling people, when you get home, you'd have an hour at least to clean up some little loose end emails, things like that. So think about it. If I'm there at 7, most people got there around 8:30, 9 o'clock. Mm-hmm. At noon, so at lunchtime, I remember joking in offices and in meetings. I'd be like, well, 10 more hours to go. We'll be all finished with this day. I mean, think about it, noon having 10 more hours of work, right? It's just a – and you and I have talked about this to some degree, Chase, and I love this conversation because it's so not a regular conversation I would have on Zoom or in a meeting with somebody or on TV. But it's It's a pressure cooker like you can never experience. And when all of us left the White House, I remember reporters would call and they would say, well, oh, a lot of your folks are going to the Hill, or some of you guys are going to corporate gigs. And is it weird that, you know, all these are a step down? And I'm like, are you upset that these are step downs? I said, well, nothing's higher than the White House. So anything's going to be a step down. That's not, of course, some people are going to go to Congress because they have institutional knowledge of the White House and how to best help their principal work with the executive branch. But it's just one of those deals that's so difficult to explain or express in a way that doesn't scare the tar out of somebody, because it is just so much work and it's so intense. Everything you do affects not just the people in this country, but people around the globe. That's just a hard thing to wrap your head around. I remember watching, I guess it was Larry Kudlow, who's a good friend of mine who did economics for the president. I prepped him for an interview he had on Fox Business. Now, we don't prep him on the economy because he knows the economy. We may tweak a little word he says and say, you say it this way, whatever. But I remember watching the markets that were kind of in a free fall that morning. And he gets on camera and starts talking. And all of a sudden, you just see him kind of plane out. And he keeps talking. And then all of a sudden, they turn green and they start going back up again. You realize the gravity of what you're saying and what it means. The bully pulpit from behind which you speak is something like you can never duplicate. That's a long answer, but you know.
No. It's what's fascinating, because it's media to the nth degree from the standpoint of, yeah, I mean, you know, I might worry about what I say in the morning, but that's only potentially getting me in trouble or making somebody pissed off at me or whatever.
Right.
Whereas you are speaking for the administration, for the country in a lot of ways when you say these things, you get on this thing. So how does that even work? I mean, you obviously have this great institutional knowledge. You understand the path for what you should be saying, but how much is just you answering the questions in an organic way, and how much are you almost kind of briefing yourself or being briefed on, no, this is the exact words or phrase that I would be saying in these interviews?
It's both. Some of the best moments are the ones that are organic, that, you know, we pick fights, or we clap back at somebody who's attacking us or the administration. But also, I mean, look, you got to be careful. You just said that. I mean, the ramifications of your words are infinite, and they're real. And so how do you articulate something? And we had, look, every press secretary who stands behind that podium has a briefing book this thick, and you can talk about a certain top line, because you're supposed to know a little about a lot. So you've got a couple of lines you can throw out there. And then after that, you know, you can ad lib as much as you want to. You can do, you know, kind of some freestyle as much as you are comfortable with. And that, to me, those are always the most fun. But, you know, you need to be careful in that role, because you are speaking on behalf of a president. You're speaking on behalf of a country. And so, you know, an errant word here or there could get us into a whole lot of trouble, not just cause headache. Because remember, my job is to make the president's job easier, right? That's what I signed up for. It's not to make his more difficult.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to make my job easier. I have to make his job easier. And so a mess up, a misspeak makes his job more difficult. So you have to be really kind of tight on certain things like that. But then you know what he wants, you know what he likes, and you can use that to your advantage in interviews as well.
It's what I find funny sometimes is they, you know, on either side of the aisle, or anybody, you or whomever, is, hey, they said this or they think this. It's like, none of this is their own personal opinions. Like, you're not getting up there and going, well, I, Hogan Gidley, believe this. Well, that,
right,
that doesn't come into any part of what you're doing whatsoever. I mean, have you had those, and I'm sure you have, but I mean, you have the moment where, you know, you miss a word or say something that maybe it didn't come out exactly right. I mean, are you all in real time almost kind of having a little bit of a panic moment and then figuring out how to recover from it?
Sometimes. And let me give one anecdote first, and then I'll give you another anecdote as it relates to your question. I give a lot of speeches around the country, but also a lot of times I speak to students in various capacities, and I'll inevitably get a question which is similar to what you're asking, which is, let's say the president says something I disagree with, or let's say I'm asked to go out there and espouse a viewpoint I don't like. And I always ask the kids in the room, they get a little nervous, to say, how many of you voted in the last election? And they all, you know, raise their hand. And then I say, how many of you voted for me? And nobody raises their hand. And I go, yeah. You didn't, you know, well, you didn't vote for me. I said, right. My job is not to articulate my vision or give my opinion. My job is to communicate what the president wants communicated. The same thing when I work for Governor Huckabee, the same thing when I work for Senator Rick Santorum or Senator Elizabeth Dole. That's what I sign up for. Now, the second part of your question, which was, what was the second part?
How do you recover if you know you've missed words or times when you, well, have, you flub so- up?
Sometimes you don't. I remember, and an article was written about me at some point in the White House, several were, but this had this exchange in it. And I remember I was going on Shannon Bream's show on Fox, and this was at the time 11 p.m., so late. And after a long day, an 11 p.m. show is not your, you know, you're not going to be the sharpest. And since I'm a morning person, I'm definitely sharper in the morning than I am the afternoon or evening, not afternoon, but. Something happened. I don't remember what it was, but it was significant enough that we had to get some people on the phone to have the conversation. Sarah and some others say, look, I'm going on. I'm going to be the first voice going forward after this issue. What are we going to do? It was something with Rudy too, Giuliani, as I recall. And this is little, but still, I didn't pick up on it in real time. And I think Shannon had asked me the question again to see if I could recover, and I didn't pick up what she was putting down. And I said, based on what we had talked about with our attorneys in the White House counsel, Sarah and others, we had basically devised a way to say there's ongoing litigation and I can't comment on that. It's a good out, something that we could say, look, you can make a point. I think I made a point and then said, but as far as that's concerned, it's ongoing litigation. Except I didn't say litigation. I said legislation, which of course has nothing to do with what I was trying to convey. There's ongoing legislation, which is stupid as it can be, but it was something at the time that, you know, it wasn't that I was blanking on the word. It was that we had just gotten off an intense call of like, look, just punt because we don't know enough about it yet. We can't really comment on ongoing litigation anyway. So let's just say, okay, fine. That's what we're going to do. But there was something else going on in the legislature at the time. So my mind, and again, it was late, so it was a little scrambled. But that was one of the instances where I blew it. And then, you know, another one of my, this is something that I didn't blow, but I got real hot about it. And I left the White House to go to work on the campaign to be the press secretary there. Trump had asked me to do that in June. I left a couple of weeks after we worked out all the details. And I went over to the campaign, and it was an interview with John Berman at CNN, and it's still on my Instagram page, by the way, and it got a lot of pickup because I think, you know, Trump at the time had all the platforms covered. He retweeted it, Dan Scavino retweeted it, and so it was mm-hmm. I remember I went from like 4,000 Instagram followers to like 22,000 Instagram followers in a day mm-hmm. because of the tweet, because of the exchange. But anyway, John Berman was asking a question. He works at CNN, was asking a question, basically trying to imply the president was racist. And I got sick of it. And I lit him up, for lack of a better word. And I'm sure someone's going to watch this and go, oh, John Berman beat you. Whatever. Go look it up yourself. You can decide. But basically, I just pointed to several instances in which this was during the campaign again, so I could talk freely in this way. And I basically, it was something Donald Trump had said that they tried to make like a racist statement. And I said, I just cut them off. And I said, do you know what an exalted cyclops of the KKK is? Well, Joe Biden sure does, because he gave a speech for one at his funeral and praised him. I said, do you know who George Wallace is? Because he's someone in the South that there was an award created for him that was given to Joe Biden, which he appreciated. Do you know what a racial jungle is? Because that's what Joe Biden said he didn't want his child growing up in. So don't sit here and tell me. I said, his, and this guy keeps trying to cut me off. And I said, Joe Biden's, you know, history on race is deplorable or whatever I said. And I said, Donald Trump was opening up his clubs and his properties to African-Americans and Jewish people while you were still popping around local news, John. And that was kind of the end of the exchange. And that was one of those ones where it was organic. In real time, that was a good back and forth with an anchor where both John Berman at CNN and myself probably got what we wanted out of that. he got me, him trying to cut me off and look at this guy being disrespectful and me just kind of brushing him back.
This doesn't have to be in media. This is anything. This is whether you're having an intense conversation with a friend, a family member, you're talking with bosses, raises, whatever. I think anybody can associate with this in a way. But what is the art of kind of saying exactly what you mean when you mean to say it? You know, a lot of people think of, hey, I wish I'd have thought about that 10 minutes ago or 15 minutes ago or yesterday. Had I just done this? I mean, there's a certain just flow and rhythm that some people have and some people don't. But is there any way to improve that?
Look, I do a lot of media training, a lot. I do some media training for people, and I've done it over the years. I was just helping a couple of people at my office kind of go through this too. I'm going to use an interview like in TV or in print, but this is applicable too for an interview at work, asking for a raise, whatever, a meeting that, you know, is going to be contentious, whatever, or just not contentious, but just informative. I always try to drill down, and I tell people this, when you're asked a question and you just said, give the answer you want to give, whatever it is, or you want to give the answer you want to give, but you don't necessarily want to answer the question that's asked, which is always something we do in media. But I always tell them to drill it down to the essence of what you want to say, find a clever way to say it. And no matter what the question is, that's the line you hit. Because that's the line that's going to be memorable. That's the line that's going to be replayed. That's the soundbite they pull out. I mean, I gave a written quote to someone the other day about a redaction in FBI documents as related to Trump. And I said something like, yeah, it's going to matter unless the redactions make it look like the pavement on turn four at Talladega, right? Something people in the South would appreciate, that hoity-toity, you know, liberal elitist reporter didn't know what I was talking about. But it got pulled and used on Fox. I didn't even say it on TV, but the quote was good enough where they used it in print, okay, as a quotable of the week. It was on Brett Baer's show, actually, at 6 o'clock on Fox. But anyway, that was organic. But there are more times often than not, there's one thing you want to say about a topic, you need to make sure you formulate the proper way to say it. It's the same thing. I had a meeting today that was intense, and I had 3 points I really wanted to hit. And no matter how many questions came during the meeting, I got it back to, yeah, but the point is, here's this one thing, here's the second thing, here's the third thing. So it's teachable and coachable to some degree, but some of it's not. Some of it, you know, you just have to have it. Mike Huckabee is the best I've ever seen at it. And this is not necessarily where you want to go with the question, but understand humanity in a sense. I remember in a campaign for president in 08, I think, and this is not a slap at anybody, just whatever. I know you got to do a lot of disclaimers on your podcast with people who don't understand what you're trying to say. There was a question about healthcare. Someone stood up and said, and this was a big field. This was 08, I think. So it was Huckabee, Romney, Gilmore, all these people on stage, Giuliani, all these people on stage. And someone asks Romney, yeah, my child just got diagnosed with cancer, or said something, the child had an ailment. How can you help? Romney hops off the stool. Number one, I do this. Number two, I do this. Number three, and he kind of litanied, that's how we would fix it. Fine answer, right? He gave them substance, knew what he wanted to do. Huckabee gets off the stool and he goes, I can't even imagine what my life would be like that in that moment if a doctor told me my child had that illness. My wife got diagnosed with cancer, he said, spinal cancer, said she'd never walk, said she whatever. But by the grace of God, she has multiple children. She's jumped out of airplanes, right? But as far as what the government can do to help you in this process, I would say there are a few things. He gave some answers too. They both gave the answer. One had a humanitarian element around it that brought someone in. Bill Clinton was great at this. Obama was pretty good at it too, to some degree, a little more elitist than Bill Clinton, but a lot more elitist than Bill Clinton, but still. So what I'm saying is some of it is teachable. Some of it just isn't. Some of it is just who you are as a person. And Romney's a robot. And so he answers things in a more robotic way. He has a talking point he wants to check off. I have a talking point I want to check off, but I'll be honest, when I left Ole Miss, because I was a broadcast journalism major, so I was in TV news. I lost my accent to a large degree. When I got into politics, I realized it's an asset. I can burn you to the ground, but if I do it with a country southern soft accent, people don't even know what happened. Your guts are all over the floor. You're bleeding to death, and I just gutted you, and you had no idea. So that's another topic altogether. But you see my point. There are ways to teach people, here's what you need to glom onto. Here's the strategy around which you answer a question, and here's the best method to get it done. And then as you practice that and as you role play that before you go into meetings, before you go into interviews, it helps you nail the line. It helps you drill down on the point. The organicness of what follows, that just depends on who you are and how you are as a communicator.
There was a message board thread playing off what you just said a few days ago, and it was discussing that across the country, not even in the South, people were hearing y'all more, and you know, the whole y'all, you guys, accents, all those different things. And I had chimed in on it, and somebody said that they had not heard me say y'all much earlier, but I seem to say it more now. And I think it's right. I think that for a long time, I sort of told myself, I'm going to teach myself to avoid it. I'm going to actually get rid of accents, but I'm going to be careful about words and these connotations that come on it. And maybe I'm wrong here. I'm just in Oxford. I haven't traveled the country or the world, but I feel like either, as you said, you're being able to play more to who you are. Or there's things that are positives to it, but I also feel like some of these things just aren't the negative connotations that they were even 10 years ago. I feel like we have adapted in some ways, in some ways good, in some ways bad, but where it just, there isn't this, oh, he said this or did this, or there's slight associated with it, or that you would teach it to be avoided the same way we might have, you know, a decade ago.
Yeah, in large measure, I think you're right, but I'm going to give you different reasons. I think, remember, back when you and I were kind of coming up, it was TV news.
Mm-hmm.
SportsCenter was big, and then it was kind of more regional, but they didn't want regional dialect. They still wanted kind of a regular accent. But then now it's, you know, HGTV, and it's, you know, Cake Boss, and it's ESPN5, and it's, you know, different, you know, My 600-Pound Life, and it's all these different shows you can be a part of that open up people's eyes to different things than just the standard hair-parted newscaster doing his thing or her thing. So I think that's part of it. But I would also argue, Chase, for you and me, when we started, right, you didn't want a negative connotation around your accent to prevent you from achieving something.
Sure.
Like, I had to take jobs I didn't want to take as I was younger. Now I can be a little bit more selective, right? Now I don't care how thick my accent gets when I show up in Oxford for a game, or when I see some of my old fraternity brothers and we're out duck hunting or whatever. When I go back to Arkansas, I'll do some, you know, it doesn't bother me. Whereas before, I was so conscious of it. So I think part of that's age too for us, in that I don't care anymore. You know what I mean? You are where you are in your career. And so now, because of your bona fides and because of your resume, no one's going to say, he says y'all too much. They're going to go, oh, he's got good experience. That's great, right? If someone's going to tinker with that, then we can have a different conversation. But I think in large measure, it has to do with the fact you're already accomplished, as am I. So, you know, when Sarah took over at the podium in the White House, you know, she's got charm. She's got a Southern accent, a softness to her that, yes, she has good, she's smart. She's got good wit, a good back and forth with reporters. But, you know, she didn't have to clean up her y'alls or, you know, be a Northeast Harvard graduate to get where she was. And so, you know, it never eroded her credibility. It just made her who she was. Maybe.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You mentioned Iowa a couple times. What is it you like so much about campaigns? You know, because I'll be honest. What do you like about it? I mean, just, you know, the days, the road, the competition, the different ways that as a communication specialist you're handling things on a day-to-day level versus in a campaign versus the governing or doing things in the White House. Because maybe there's tons of people like me. I'm keeping up with news. I'm aware of what's going on in the country, but I'm not necessarily getting some adrenaline rush out of reading the news every day from a governing standpoint. But I love campaigns. I love the strategy of campaigns. I follow those or read books about those from just simply the trying to get people to buy into your message or your vision or your votes or all these different things that I would assume, especially in your job, it brings a certain amount of day-to-day. I mean, frankly, it's as competitive as anything you probably do from the standpoint of just handling what's coming, and there's a scoreboard at the end of it.
It's competitive chaos. There's no question about it. But campaigning on its face is so inherently awkward. So people who are good at it are kind of unique. It goes so many directions with this. I love the day-to-day new stuff. I love getting in a car in Iowa and it being, you know, 15 degrees, and you're going out across – you know, it's a 4-hour drive to your stop. Okay. It's not like this state's not a lot of close little pockets. You got to drive a long way to places, and you're seeing the tundra, for lack of a better word, this wind, you know, cause there's no trees to block anything. You see this wind coming across the road, and inside the car, I think I even had this on Instagram from years ago. I could write my name in ice on the inside.
I've seen this. Yeah.
It's cold, okay? That's kind of fun to not have to dress up and wear a tie, to wear, you know, things that you can get out. But also to talk to real people who care about real things. Some of them are very odd. Some of them are very funny. Some of them are mean. But to watch candidates handle that and me think about how I would handle it has helped shape me, too, as a communicator in my career. FYI, BTW, I don't want to get anywhere near a campaign in Iowa right now. No way. I don't want to do that right now. As soon as I say that, I'll be in Iowa. But nonetheless, there was a documentary that came out at the time because I was working for Santorum, and no one was covering us. We were in last place. And a documentary crew asked if they could cover us. I was a comms director, and I said, sure, because I wanted some cameras around for him to make him think it was on the news. You know, like I had to give him some mental uplifting moments. And they did this. It's a guy named AJ Schnack, and he's won a lot of awards. In fact, I think he has some sports. Oh, he did the McGuire Sosa one. I think he did that one. I saw it on a plane. I texted him after. I was like, you did this? He said, yeah. But the documentary is called Caucus, and because in Iowa there isn't a primary, it's a caucus. So in essence, it starts after Michelle Bachmann had won the caucus, or excuse me, the straw poll, and Santorum was nowhere. And basically, they crossed, and Santorum wins. Okay, big deal. I'm in it a few times. That's not why I'm telling you that. Not that self-effacing. But it's so fascinating because Michelle Bachmann's husband is like in the back of the room, and you can hear it. It says at the bottom, has the text at the bottom, subtitles, because you can't really hear it. And he says, hey, let's thumb wrestle. Just old veterans, just back here, like, he's like, let's thumb wrestle for, if I win, you'll vote for Michelle. And he's basically like, yeah, I lost both my thumbs in Korea. Like, what? And then, if I recall, her husband turns to another guy. He's like, hey, let's thumb wrestle for her. I'm like, no, no, stop with the thumb wrestle. You lost it, right? It's so odd, and you got to watch it because it opens with like these people singing the national anthem and these big heavy guys and their bellies are coming out underneath their shirts. And it's just America. It's so much fun to get out there. It's frustrating and it's tiring and it's sad and it's happy. And we stay in the White House. Our highs are really high and our lows are really low. Nowhere is that more important than the White House, obviously, but campaigns the same way. You have good days, you have bad days. You get a feel for it. It starts to get your adrenaline. You know, your candidate catches on. People are all over him or her, and you got to get him away and work with the press. And, you know, Santorum went from nobody to being in first place and cameras everywhere. And so it was a crash course in building a rocket ship mid-flight. But the reason I bring that up is because that's part of the campaign life. And if you watch that documentary, they did a good job capturing how that is and the conversations you have to have and the questions you get where you're kind of, you don't know what they're talking about sometimes. You have no idea what this one issue is, this constituent is talking about. And you're trying to be nice and you're trying to help, but you don't understand. There's a communications problem. So it, stuff like that, you know, I don't know if that answers your question, but you know, that's one of the reasons I find it so fascinating.
So did they just get lucky? I mean, were y'all one of the few campaigns they could actually get on and then he takes off this meteoric rise? I mean, how did it become that they ended up getting a winner out of that?
Well, Rick, we had decided I was part of this, but it wasn't like me and him decided, but we were going to do this. We were going to go to all 99 counties, which is something that a famous senator from Iowa named Chuck Grassley still does to this day. Every year goes to all 99 counties. So we said, we're going to go to all 99 counties. We're going to put in the work. If they reward us, they reward us. If they don't, they don't. But this is the only way I know how to do it. And Rick went to all 99 counties, some multiple times. We did everything we could. It was just a clinic in how you should run a campaign. And Huckabee had done something similar in 08. So this wasn't completely unique. And every candidate had kind of had their shot. You'll remember Herman Cain rose and then fell, and Michelle Bachmann rose and fell. Rick Perry rose and fell. All these people had these successes and then kind of started to fall apart. And Rick was the guy out there who'd put in all the work. So by the time Christmas rolled around, we were the only ones, you know, we were kind of the alternative because everyone had seen what everyone else had. When you're on a campaign, you've got to answer some of the toughest questions. You've got to get your point of view out there. And so people always say, oh, that person would be a good candidate. You wait and see until the voters start to hear what that candidate is all about, what they believe, what they like and dislike, and then they can kind of fall off. That happened with Rick, and those that documentary crew just happened to be there for all of it. So, you know, there's actually a group from LSU who was there at the time. Mm-hmm. And they asked me to take a picture for them. So I'm like, sure. So I had my hat on backwards and my coat on. And I found out the numbers had come in. I got a text that poll numbers had come in. And I went to the guy who did the poll numbers. He was there. And I said, what are the numbers? Because I don't know. And I thought, oh, you don't know. And I said it in a way I thought he was lying to me. He didn't know. And then they came out and we were, I think, in second place at the time. So we knew it was real. But that camera crew captured it all. It's a fascinating documentary.
Several things there in that. And one, and I think this goes for, you know, media on both sides of the aisle, politicians and whatnot, because you know, Arkansas, South Carolina, Mississippi for college and your history, obviously been in the South, been a lot of real people. Whether it be you or just people you are around a ton in D.C., do you have to almost kind of like catch yourself reminding yourself of the normal American, if you will? I mean, and things. I mean, is there a certain – it's not like L.A., but, I mean, there is a certain – whether you want to call it elitist, whether you want to call it people who are just around like-minded people in that way. I mean, do you either from a media or a politician standpoint see people who simply lose their way once they get in that environment?
All the time. This town is full of them. And I think I've done a pretty good job kind of sticking to the old, you know, no one cares mentality, meaning when we have these talks inside our beltway bubble, inside the beltway that goes around DC, we all are hearing our own chattering mm-hmm. class. I'm like, guys, no one cares about this outside. I'll give you a great example. The Speaker of the House race, it went in until midnight. People were talking about it for a week. It was days of jockeying and everyone here cared about it. And I went on radio shows. I went on TV shows and I said, guys, they care. The American people care from the standpoint of they want good policy, but they don't care about this jockeying. What they want are politicians to do the things they promise. They want someone to focus on the border and crime and inflation and high prices for gas and groceries. That's what people care about. Stop with this speaker's race. But here, that drives so much of the news that it's what we all talk about. And honestly, you've got a bunch of political junkies, a lot of nerds here in town who care about things like that. It's fascinating to some people. It's romantic to some people because it is the seat of all the power in the world. And it is. But to understand that when you go home for Christmas or you go home for Thanksgiving or you go somewhere else and you get out in the woods and you put your boots on, you load up your gun, you're out goofing around with your friends, having a beer, no one cares. No one cares. And I have to remind myself of that less than a lot of people, I think, but I still have to remind myself of it too, because I'm in the middle of it every day.
You obviously want to, whatever you're focused on, whoever you're working for, you want to push that to their constituents, the people on cable news, or when you're giving quotes or whatnot. But what is the, and maybe there isn't, but I'm just kind of curious your thought in general from a Fox News, CNN, MBC, Newsmax, whoever we're talking about. It feels like all that's doing is pushing, and maybe I'm wrong, you can correct me, it's pushing us more into confirmation bias by the day, where we're hearing so much of necessarily one thing, we're not necessarily getting a ton of all over the place. Is it that true? And do you feel like that is destructive or repairable? Where do you sort of fall on that right now?
There is a reason that the media's popularity sits somewhere between Congress and COVID. And it's because they've been lying to people for a long time. And you hit on confirmation bias. It is. The news has basically become the editorial pages. You go there to have your opinion solidified or to yell at somebody else's opinion. You're not there to learn information. Now, you know, Trump would always come in. He'd be like, Hogan, who's the best to us? Who's the worst to us? Trump motions. And he would say, who's the best? Who's the worst? And I would say, honestly, and I'll call him out here. I think CNN, Washington Post, usually the worst in large measure because what they tell you is their news, but they're not. That's the real problem. It's the ones that try and I'm trying to give a really good word to burn under the ground here, but they're so not self-important, but they don't even see what they're doing. They're telling you it's news. You know, CNN has that James Earl Jones saying the most trusted name in news. I often wonder how many takes it took him to do that without cutting up in the laughter, because that's just stupid. They're not the most trusted name in news. They have a lot of good opinions. They have a lot of bad opinions, and that's what their shows are. But a lot of these stations have news divisions where they do have news programs, but then others are just, you know, Sean Hannity knows who he is. He knows he's not independent necessarily. He says that on air. He understands that. Brett Baer, Straight News. That's a different program. Fair, balanced, and unafraid, he says. And I think the difference between you and me and a lot of other people in middle America, they don't know. I wish I could find him. I still try to find him. But he was one of my professors at Ole Miss. Charles Retteri. Do you remember him?
I don't. No.
He was my favorite. I love Ralph Brassett too, but Charles was my favorite. And he was a reporter in Memphis. This guy, this is probably a mischaracterization, but he was an atheist socialist. But if you put one editorialized word in a TV package, it was an F. You got failed for it. Because he knew what news was. And he felt there was a responsibility for you as a journalist. Now, we'd sit back in his office and talk politics, and you knew exactly where he stood. But you'd never see it in a story or a report. That's not a thing anymore. Because remember, I think people in large measure are getting ahead on their opinions, or getting ahead on firebrands. So there's profit in it. And look, if you're Jim Acosta at CNN, and you get a promotion as the chief White House correspondent, being who you are and acting the way you do, then everybody underneath you who wants that job, what does that tell them? I've got to be that way. to get ahead, right? And they're not wrong, because that's what CNN wants. I'm not trying to pick on CNN. I'm saying that's just a fact. And so for me, it's so layered, because I was in TV news for so long, and I've seen this just devolve into this, as you said, a confirmation bias. It's rare that, I mean, the American people don't trust the media, and when who have divisions that actually put forth real news. And then it's a long answer, but it's so layered and so weird. But for the most part, yeah, news almost doesn't exist anymore.
So tie those two things up. I know I've kept you for a while now. Is, I mean, I don't, not necessarily percentage. I'm not asking for a math thing or anything overly statistical, but just in general, when you're doing a campaign, are you simply trying to get as much of your base out, or is there actually a number of voters in the middle who are listening to offsides? I mean, how much is actually in the middle that's gettable? Or are you simply trying to make sure you capitalize your base and your constituents that are already with you?
Yeah, it's interesting. It depends on the race. It depends on statewide, national, whatever. I remember sure. Rush Limbaugh used to say, and honestly, I got to meet Rush later in life, and one of the coolest things I got to do was he came to get his award that night, the Medal of Honor, Medal of Freedom. And he and I were texting ahead of time, and he says, I'm going to be there at this time. I met him out front and out back and walked him through. And we got there. Trump wasn't ready yet to take pictures with the people that were going to be in the gallery. And we sat and talked for 45 minutes, just Rush Limbaugh, myself, and his wife, which to me was like the end all be all. I got to talk politics with the gold standard, Rush Limbaugh. But I'm going somewhere with that. You were talking about how, remind me of the question.
Basically, how to win elections. Is it people in the middle, or are you simply trying to promote your base?
Yeah. And he said, it's the middle is a fallacy. This is not exactly right what he said, but the middle can be a fallacy. You need to turn out your election. Go back and look at Bush. What he did was he took, I don't remember the numbers. These aren't right, so no one checked on this, but like he took 10 million from the previous election and turned it into 14 million. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama took 10 million of his base and turned it into 14 million of his. That's how he won. I would argue that's correct to some degree, because you've got to get your base excited. You have to get your base out talking about you as a candidate. You have to get them to go vote. You have to get them to get other people to vote. But at the same time, those people in the middle, there's a reason that suburban women swung massively to Republicans in the 2022 midterms. Because we were talking about the things they cared about: crime, southern border, inflation, because they're the ones out, in a lot of households, they pay for gas and for groceries. They know what it costs to feed and clothe their children, to go out to dinner with their husband. They know what that costs. And so they understand that issue. They understand that message. The messenger matters too. How you tell them something, how you say something absolutely matters. The brushness, the brashness of Trump in 2016 was new. People liked someone who just kind of cut through all the bull, got rid of, as you said, that beltway mentality and said, the people of America, this, I'm here for you. They liked that. And he won a lot of those people in the middle. So it's a real long answer I don't want to unpack on the show, but I'll just say it's both. You've got to get that base ginned up. But at the same time, picking off anybody in the middle you can do will always – that'll pad the stats, right? Because there are a lot of people who in this last election, the abortion issue drove out a lot of the base from the left. In some states, it was young people, but from a vast majority, young people really didn't turn out any more than they normally do. That was something I think the right didn't kind of count on as much, because they thought people would vote the economy and other things. And they did in large measure. That's why the conservatives took back the House. But they staved off, the left was able to stave off some of the challenges from the right because of other issues too. Some people are single issue voters. Some people, have multiple issues. They rank. I mean, it's a long, complicated answer, but the short answer is you got to get out your base, and you got to get out more of the base than you typically do if you're going to win a national election. But then helping, you can get some in the middle too. That's good.
Last thing, who's going to play quarterback in the fall?
You remember the story I told you, Chase, when I was for the campaign, I had to call and do like a pep talk for people in North Carolina going door to door. And they were saying, you know, they would get on there and say, "Hey, I'm Chase Parham from Oxford, Mississippi. I have a question. Do you think we really can win North Carolina, whatever?"
Oh, and I, you know, that's right.
And that guy, there was a guy from Oxford, and I can't remember how Ole Miss came out, but I said, "I went to Ole Miss," and they started screaming, "Hotty toddy." I said, "Yeah, hotty toddy." And so you have the press secretary for the president of the United States on the call to ask questions about this election. And we were playing Kentucky that weekend, and the guy goes, I think it was defense. He said, "You think our corners can shut down Kentucky's offense on the road in Lexington?" I'll hang up and listen. And I was like, hang up and listen. Like, that's the question you want to ask me? I was like, I don't know. But because I listened to you and Neil, I had some understanding of what was going on with defense and what we were trying to do schematically. So I was able to answer the guy's question, which was kind of funny. Talk about getting out of the beltway. That was a great question to have. You know, I'm going to answer this a couple ways because I would like to maybe ask you a couple questions while I have – because I got you now, and I'm going to take your time. Sure. I don't care who's back there. It could be Jeremiah Masoli. It can be Jackson Dart. What's his name? Spencer from Oklahoma State.
Yeah.
And it could be the guy we got from LSU. It doesn't matter.
Walker Howard.
Howard. If our line – is what it was last year, we're going to have problems. It doesn't matter who's back. I don't care if it's Brent Schaefer, for heaven's sakes. No one's outrunning those edge rushers if we can't buy them some time. No one can pick up our defense. And it really does go to the – speaks to the elite level of our running back in this last year to be able to get through some of those holes, cut the way they did. The vision, golly, I was blown away at Judkins and what he was able to accomplish. But I think it starts and ends with offensive and defensive lines. You know, we saw that in the playoff game with the Bengals when everyone said three new offensive linemen, they're going to get torched. And they didn't. Not only did they hold up, but they dominated in the trenches. That's how you win football games. And speaking of the Bengals, Mike Hilton, man, that guy's good. What a football player he is. But
he is – he's been that dude from the beginning. I mean, Neil and I were talking about it on the show this morning as of we're taping on this on Monday afternoon. Is, you know, he was a little undersized out of Sandy Creek in high school, and then he ends up, you know, at Ole Miss. I mean, he was the spy of Manziel and all these different things, you know, over the course of the years. And I do think from a college level, Neil said it, he's not mentioned enough in that number one top group of A, defenders, what he was actually in school, because you look at his stats and what the impact he made, he was higher than a lot of the guys we talk about from that era. And then now he's become a perennial elite NFL football player, playing that kind of that hybrid safety linebacker role that he does there for the Bengals.
It really is impressive what he's able to do in the size, you know, he is. You know, and I'm always fired up at him. I love Dawson Knox too, so I love watching him as well. I always pay attention to those teams with Ole Miss players, of course, but good for Mike Hilton, man. God, what a great player he is. And he, like you said, I think you said today on the podcast, he could have almost taken out Allen. You know what I mean? I mean, he hit him. Whew, that was rough. He almost got that fumble that, you know, I guess they called it a forward pass. But I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say who I think I will tell you who I think the quarterback's going to be.
All right.
I think it's going to be Dart. That's what I think. Now, let me just put some meat on that bone. Because the stats between Spencer and Jackson are pretty much the same from their year, Jackson knows the system. Give him a lineman that he can stand by. Jackson Dart took some shots this year. Man, that guy's tough. I think because of the rules with transfer portal, you know, like you said, I think someone said this on the podcast that if you get to, was it March or May or whatever? And one of them is going to be third string because Howard's going to be your second string. then one of them just transfers. That's the business of this now. If the NIL money makes this a more business-oriented experience, the college football player, then they're going to have to understand. Speaking to you, you talk about Lane Kiffin with his pro mindset. That's a pro mindset. We're going to bring in another quarterback, beat him or don't. You can leave at the end of the year or they can, right? So there's some of that I kind of respect, probably isn't the right word, although I do. I'm going to be interested to see. But you know, I mean, look, Dart missed some throws, missed some reads last year, but every quarterback in the country does that. When you don't have time to set up and even think about it, I think that was a disservice. It'd be a disservice to any quarterback back there, I think. So I'm going to say Jackson Dart. And we're going to see how stupid I look in a few months. But that's
it's the incumbent. I mean, no, you look at the stats, you're right. I mean, if anything, Dart – Sanders' best season, Dart's numbers from this year are still very comparable to that from Sanders' 4 years. But, you know, the other side of it is why spring's going to be entertaining and why as a talking head, we're going to do it a lot over the course of the podcast, is you don't bring Spencer Sanders in with no chance. I mean, that makes no sense. So, I mean, he's going to have every opportunity, and there's something you like about him. And, frankly, there's something you don't like about Dart. And the same thing. Or again, you wouldn't be doing this. I mean, you didn't see Ole Miss go all out with an NIL package, and I get NIL is only a year old, but they wouldn't have done it if Matt Corral was coming back for his last year. We go, hey, we're going to go grab a Big 12 starter and challenge this over the course of the season. I mean, there is something to that. So
I think, to me, and I may be remembering this wrong, but I remember Corral when Kiffin came in and Corral had his first year, he wasn't great. Like, he was okay. He was good. You know, he made some bad – remember that 6 picks against Arkansas? He had some problems.
He had 2 really bad games.
And that – but then that next year, obviously, he is what he became, which was just elite in just about every level in the college game. And so I keep thinking Dart's going to be in that same little category. I may be wrong. But, you know, again, give him a line. He's got the run game. And I think he'll be a whole – I think you're going to see a whole different guy back there. But, again, that's my limited – football knowledge, so we'll see.
Are you enjoying your schedule? It's at least a little lighter than it was a few years ago.
It's a whole lot lighter. You know, I even get a podcast in or two now that I can actually listen to you guys and you know, some other podcasts where I kind of get some news from in real time, which I like. You know, I didn't get to get back for a game this year in Oxford. I really wanted to do that. I got last year to A&M when we won at night when it was freezing cold on the pick six. But I'll tell you, I was in the box, which I've never been before. I felt so fancy. But I remember looking at somebody and I said, what? We hadn't had a pick six on this team since, like, I was in school. Like, I made some comment. I said, I can't remember. I said it was like Cody Pruitt against A&M at A&M was like the last time we had a pick six. And the next play, we had that pick six. I was like, yeah, okay. It's clear that I need to spend every game in the box in this one spot and help out the team, which is the way I can do it. But, you know, I really want to see how the construction stuff goes, because I saw them starting to do – they'd started the Manning
– The Manning Center will be completely done this summer. It's on schedule. They're doing a lot of remodel renovations to the Manning Center. It's all good. It's this summer for that, and they will they'll be there. They put the stadium on hold for frankly multiple reasons: construction costs, NIL instead of donations.
Joe Biden,
being honest, there's a lot. Got that one in. You know, a lot of different stuff there. But for Manning Center is one that they absolutely are having on schedule, and I think everybody who is displaced, like offices and all that stuff in the Manning Center, I think they're getting back in maybe June or July.
Well, I was there this past summer. Actually, I was there the week before the first game. I was there. I had to leave on the Friday before the first game. So I was there doing some stuff there, giving a speech. But I saw they were doing it. And again, I used to work out. You know, I played tennis. I got to go in there and work out at those places. So it's always kind of fascinating to get back and see what they've done to it. But, you know, look, I think – you go online, you see those videos of like LSU's facilities, or you see, you know, Alabama's facilities, and you're like, yeah, this is, by the time you build it, it's almost, you know, out of date. It's almost obsolete at that point, you know? So I will be anxious to see how they actually do it and what the amenities the players get, because you got to keep up with the Joneses and those things. And, you know, we got money to do the facilities the right way. I hope we do it, because that pavilion is, speaking of facilities, it's a good one in and of itself. So,
yeah, it's,
I did.
Go ahead.
No, I had a question about. I've been listening to you guys on the transfer portal, and I'm not trying to like blow smoke here. You guys do really good stuff explaining transfer portal. Really enjoy that, and the problems that persist, and the problems that are created by it. Some I think they'll address, some they won't. Whatever, it's fine. But and as Neil likes to say, and he's right, it's too new to know if just going portal heavy is going to be your, you know, the way forward or not. Whatever. Are there any other, I know you probably can't say on this, but do we have a lot? I mean, there's a lot that can happen because the portal, when is the portal stuff completely over? That's not till spring, right?
Well, I mean, yeah. So the portal window is currently closed, but anybody who's already in the portal, they just have to enroll at some point. That can be this week for January. That can be for August. They could just hang out the entire semester just sitting in the portal as long as they're already there. And then the portal will reopen May 1st. From May 1st until May 15th, because it will give everybody who has been through a spring another chance to jump in the portal after spring practice if they don't like their current situation. And then you do it all over again. And then you're simply, okay, are they going to be here in June for the summer? Are they going to be here August 20th for the fall semester? It is never ending. And it has some positives from a straight media coverage standpoint, because it's always sure. something. But, God, I really do kind of miss those windows where we were just going to the big February signing day, and that was the party, and then kind of stopped. And, yeah, you'd have some transfers, but it looked – I mean, I remember essentially spying on Jeremiah Masoli when he came to Oxford that weekend in 2010. You're trying to go, hey, is he here? Is he at practice? Where is he at? That was a different time. But now it's just the never-ending nature that – and I'm not saying – I'm not digging ditches. I love my job, but – you're just kind of always on call because it's so new. You're not only on call as in what's somebody doing or are they coming in or what they doing or else, but it's what does it mean and what are the rules? I mean, I was talking to somebody yesterday about Spencer Sanders from the standpoint of, okay, if he comes to Ole Miss, can he transfer in August to somebody else, somewhere else, if he loses the job? What's required from that? Because he only has 1 year of eligibility remaining. He can't sit out a year. He can't do whatever. That doesn't right. exist for him. Well, can he graduate, or does he have to have a certain number of hours at Ole Miss to be able to become a graduate transfer to then play somewhere else? Because you have to have that for a second time through the portal. You would have to be a graduate transfer. There's just things that I feel like the only comparison I can make, and the one of my comparison is much more detailed, but is if I started covering a professional sport tomorrow and they said, okay, it's trade season and now you have to learn the entire CBA in a week. Like, I feel like you're just on this crash course of, we don't even know all the things we're trying to know, but if these things happen, what does that mean? And what are the rules or what are the stipulations beyond that?
I think, I don't remember which one of you said it, but it was like, could you imagine if Jamar Chase at the end of 1 year was like, hey, I'm on the market, just whatever the market pays, I'm going. And then the next year, yeah, he goes to the Vikings. The next year he's like, hey, I'm back in. What are you guys now about free agent again? It really does. It sets up kind of a weird recipe for disaster. At the very least, some chaos I don't think a lot of people are going to be too happy about. But, you know, this whole, I had some of my friends, this ruins it for me and paying players. I'm like, give me a break. They were paying your players at Georgia. Stop it. They've been doing that forever. Don't pretend like that's a new thing. It's just now it's public. And I think it's better because now you get to see kind of the whole game. I will say a point you made today, see, I do listen, was that they should have a database.
It should be
public. Why not, right? They're signing because of these things. And that's something that – I don't want to get into an A&M thing here, but no one's going, look, I really love Adidas, so I'm going to – I love maroon. That's where I'm going to go because I – like, give me a break, right? Everyone knows why you're going there. Just publish it. I'd like to see the market value for some of these kids, and good for them. They're making the colleges and universities a bajillion dollars. Sure, whatever. I don't have a problem with it.
If the car dealer or the whatever is okay paying the kid, then be fine to put your name on it and go, hey, here's the contract I gave him, and I stand by it. Public.
Yeah. And I think y'all said something like soccer contracts, these kids are 18, whatever they are. All those things are made public. Hockey contracts, they're made public. Baseball, same thing. I don't know why we wouldn't know that, but I think I'm gonna be interested. I'm so fascinated as to where that goes, where that whole process goes, because are they going to protect the kid? Does it, in a way that they don't want them to see the contracts? Is that protection? Does it make it better? I don't know.
I think that, honestly, I think it's a self-fulfilling protection. I think it's so the players themselves aren't seeing what the other guy at their position are getting. I think it's hiding it from the team as much as the fan base or the public or anything else, because I think you're talking about trying to avoid locker room issues with, hey, that guy's behind me and I'm playing over him, but he's getting $6,000 a month or $10,000 a month or $1,500 a month. And I'm only getting this, and I'm getting Jack. I think they're almost trying to protect themselves.
That happened at a school, right? One of the schools got the spreadsheet. I would, and I could guess who it was, but I would say, isn't that weird though? Like in the NFL, if Chase Barham, you're a cornerback, you're a shutdown corner, you've been proven, and then I get drafted as a cornerback for the same team, and they're paying me some massive contract that's more than you're making. I don't know how that works. I'm assuming that still happens in the NFL, but it's similar here in that. You're a cornerback at Ole Miss, and you've been doing it for 3 years, and they want me as a freshman to come in, and they pay me more than they're paying you in NIL money. I could see that be a real problem. People would be really angry about that. Like, you put in the work, you've done it, and now I'm some kid from some high school in the middle of nowhere making more money, never done it, never played it down yet. Seems kind of odd.
Well, and the reason why it's to a higher nature are two things. One is the 18-year-old is typically going to be more immature than the professional player who's been through the process and whatever. And then the rules are the same. If the professional player is not making as much or making more, well, he gets that opportunity for that second contract. He's going to come up in free agency where if he's playing well, another team's going to come get him. And now it's sort of the same principle, but if you're trying to stay where you are, well, I mean, that requires the NIL to just, hey, here's more money. And it's just, there's no function to it where I can look and see exactly here are the rules, because there aren't rules. I mean, it's just, can I get this from somebody?
It's
can I get this from somebody else? It's chaos. I mean, that's
it's
the word.
Thunderdome, baby.
It's discombobulation all the way around. That's what it is. So, and here we are just hanging on tight and riding it and hoping we can figure it out at some point, or it the market levels itself or whatever happens. I mean, we don't have enough time on this show, but I mean, the thing that I'm worried about is there's a court case in California right now if any of this rev share comes through, because it will completely change the college model. It's not sustainable. And you have way too many people trying to force decisions that are not actually in these buildings or involved with the sports or the universities or anything else that are pushing things that simply are not doable at this point. So. Yeah, there's a court case in California that they are saying that for men's basketball, women's basketball, and football, I think are the three, is that 50% of the revenue should go to the players. Well, that's a level that would destroy every Olympic sport at every school. You would not be able to fund every sport that is not the basically football and men's basketball, baseball, and a few other schools.
By the way, how's the book been received on your baseball book?
It's been good. I am thrilled I did it. I am very happy for the people who were involved in winning the title. I had a lot of fun promoting it, and I'm very glad that the primary promotion is over and I'm done. And I'm actually pretty close to it now. I'm not ready yet, and I'm not going to break news here. I'm actually pretty close to another project that I will announce at some point. But I'm enjoying a break. I am thoroughly enjoying Christmas passed. That was kind of, we're going to do all the signings. We're going to promote it through the holidays. And then outside of, I think the Kindle edition goes live in like a week or something like that. We're kind of shutting down. It is what it is. It was great. Enjoyed meeting a ton of people. Just enjoyed the process. I'd like a little more time. It's writing a book in 60 days is not recommended, but
all right. I know we're running so long here.
You're good.
Give me two offensive, defensive player. Just in Ole Miss past, that your favorites?
Football?
Yeah.
Let's see. I mean, because I've got a couple thousand. Laramie Tunsil on offense.
Ugh.
His personality, his dominance, everything about Laramie was just fun. I hate that he was not available to us more than he was. When I turned 8 years old, I had a Russ Shouse birthday cake. when I was little. So there was that. He actually, I have two balls behind me, and I think I mentioned one of these on the podcast. The one up here is from the Gator Bowl team. That's the whole team signing the Gator Bowl ball. I was, I don't know, 7, 8 years old, something like that. And then Romero and Deuce from the Arkansas game, and I think 97 or 98 are the two balls there. So, I mean, those are the guys that I grew up on. I mean, I can remember whatever year I was when Romero signed, and it's one of the few things where I'm, like, friends with him now, and it's a little bit weird for your child self to be thinking about that. But, I mean, I remember having a note sent in to me in whatever grade I was in telling me Romero signed with Ole Miss when I was in, like, elementary school or junior high or whatever I was. Like, that was a thing. You're all like, hey, where'd the guy from Shannon go and all this stuff. So, no, it's those
kind of
guys.
Didn't he just narrowly almost beat Georgia twice? Didn't he have, like, some high ankle thing and then –
Yeah, and then in the year that State won the West, he broke his collarbone on the last play of the game. They were down like 7 or whatever. He threw a Hail Mary, and he missed the Egg Bowl because of a broken collarbone. So
that's what it was, a collarbone. And I remember, well, I think one year was his leg or his ankle, but I met him at the first bowl we went to with Freeze, Liberty,
the Birmingham.
Birmingham. I was there. We had a big group. All my Birmingham friends went over there, and I saw Romero in the jetway, that's it, planes, whatever you call it, the concourse. And I was just like, I stopped him, was just like, dude, you were one of my first kind of big follows for Ole Miss. That was cool. This is a random story, but this isn't Ole Miss related so much, but I was thinking about this. And I know, I think I've told you this before, but I think your audience, if they're even close to listening, this would appreciate. So Burrow, I got to go to a couple of national championship games with Donald Trump. And I remember telling him, he asked me, should I go to the Alabama-LSU game? I said, oh, yeah, 100%. But you're not going to experience – you did pro games your whole life. You're never going to see it. He goes, what do you mean? I said, it is the loudest, craziest – I'm telling you. He came back the next day, called me, said it was amazing. But we went to the national championship game with Burrow. So I'm in the box, the president's in there, myself. I talked to Vince Vaughn, Barry Sanders – was in there, legs as big around as, yeah, he was my height. Drew Brees with his family. What was cute was his kids were so mad because they all had on LSU stuff, of course. And his kids were so mad, like, we're losing, you know, whatever. And Brees just put his head, it was so dismissive, but dad's sweet. Like, he just kind of wrote and said, I think we're going to be okay, son. And I thought to myself, when he said that, I thought, I don't know if he's just trying to calm the kid down, but if anybody knows if LSU is going to be okay, I think he, like, I felt like, I think LSU is going to win just because of that one offhanded comment he made to his kid. Like, oh, we're fine. What I've seen, I know what's going to happen. Like, it just kind of, you know what I mean? And Tim McGraw was in there, et cetera, et cetera. Ezekiel Elliott came running through there like a weird person. The receiver, crazy hair. He made the incredible catch. He was with the Giants. Now he's
Odell Beckham.
Odell Beckham was there too. And then I see this couple over there, and they said, that's Joe Burrow's parents. I said, oh. So I went over and I said, Mr. and Miss Burrow, my name's Hogan Gidley. And they said, oh, no. We're big fans. We love you on TV, all of this. And I was like, oh, that's good. I was like, now you're from Amory, right? And they said, yeah, we're from Amory. I said, 30 minutes down the road, couldn't send him to Oxford. Like, what's the problem? And they started laughing. They just started laughing. I was like, it's 30 minutes, guys. I mean, Baton Rouge is a lot for, I don't even know what you were thinking.
It's an hour and 10 minutes, Hogan. I'm from Amory. Okay, look, it's an hour.
We just laughed about it, whatever. And I said, look, congratulations on your son. What a great year he's had and all this. And they said, oh, look, we appreciate what you do and thank you so much. And that was it. So fast forward, when Eddie O and the team come to the White House, and Trump brings them in the Oval Office, he's taking pictures with every one of them individual, shaking hands. I'm talking to Orgeron, telling him whatever. I see Darius Geis in there too. He starts running his mouth about Ole Miss and whatever. We start jawing about it, just laughing. And beside the Resolute desk, I see Burrow sitting there in one of the chairs. So he's just by himself, kind of awkward, you know, he's kind of an odd, right? And so I just walk over and I said, "Hey, Josh," I said, "my name's Hogan Gidley." He's like, "Yeah. My parents said they met you in the box." And I was like, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, when we won the," I said, "congratulations on the championship." He goes, "Yeah, I saw my parents that night and they're like, hey, we met Hogan Gidley up in the box." And I was like, his parents, like national championship night, told Joe Burrow, "Hey, we just met Hogan Gidley up in the box." Like that was their thing. It just made me laugh so hard. But he, you guys touched on this in the podcast. Man, that guy's good.
Oh, he's
he was great in college, but he is really unbelievable. And so back to the Ole Miss part, I was trying to think of a player. I mean, obviously, I'm an Eli guy for sure. But like the ones that I, you know, the Deuce McAllisters of the world, you start to wish you had those pieces all in the same. I know all fans do this, but you start to think about that. Patrick Willis, I thought, was such a good kid. He was so good. I like that Freeze first team with the Cody Pruitts and the, you know, I mean, I thought they were great.
That was one of the best teams ever from the standpoint of simply believing in themselves, the redemption, kind of finding itself. I mean, look, Freeze can be a hell of a football coach, and he was that year. I mean, he really was. He was phenomenal.
He's gonna be good at Auburn.
He is. I think he's gonna do well. I
think he's gonna do really well.
That team will always kind of be one to me. It goes, yeah, that's one you just enjoyed that you covered because of the entire story around them and coming from the beat-down nature of what that Houston Nutt era was in 2011 and just seeing that 6-6, 7-6 can be such a nice thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That doesn't always happen.
We had a group. We had 30 people got a bus at this buddy's house in Birmingham. We all went over together. And you'd have thought we were going to the national show. We had a ball.
Yeah.
Like, and we didn't care if we won that game. We just wanted to go and congratulations to kids who'd faced such adversity and had such a roller coaster of, you know, the coaches and the carousel and the whole thing. It was a really kind of, like you said, a redemptive type story, a really cool thing. I'm sure covering it was kind of fun for you guys too. Mm-hmm. But
anyway. Yeah, that Egg Bowl in 12 was one that always kind of, to get them bowl eligible, because getting bowl eligible is what ignited what came after that. Like, if they don't get to a bowl, I don't know that they get Laramie and Laquan and Robert, because you had to show a proof of concept that I think took that 6th, 7th win, something along those lines.
Yeah, and that's why I think, look, I'm a Kiffin fan, but like I think we've talked about before, maybe offline, but you know, you had the ball on your racket, to use a tennis term, to win a couple of those games you didn't, and Alabama was one of them. It was your offense. It was the offense. Now there were a lot of factors out there, obviously, but those are things I think he's got some proof of concept, but there are some wins he's left out on the. Out on the field a few, and I think that this year is going to be kind of again, it's a setup for 24. There's no question about that. But usually Ole Miss fans are looking to the next year. It seems like we're looking for the next 2 years, but that's okay.
Yeah, you know, it's a deal with Lane where I think one of his improvements still has to be that he's so competitive that once that main carrot is off the table, still keeping the same intensity that the season can still become good in a way, because you know, it's about winning the West and beating Alabama and these really lofty big goals. And then once that out of the way, you almost wonder if he has a little lull at times. He goes, okay, that's not where we are. And now it kind of, you know, getting to the Music City Bowl is not what's on Lane's mind when he starts a season. That's for sure. But
I agree. And the fact that Freeze did it, right? Like he beat Alabama a couple times and did his stuff. I think it there's proof positive it can be done. There's just, you know, got to do it, I guess. It's not all the time, but when the opportunity is there, you got to take it, you know.
24 back in Oxford. It's one that they're looking ahead. It's one they're going to need in 2 years, just saying. So,
yeah, sure.
Hey, I appreciate this, bud. Ton of time. I'm sorry I kept you so long, but I really enjoyed it. We'll see where things go.
Anytime, Chase. Y'all keep up the good work, and I'll keep following it because I really do enjoy it. It's a break from D.C. for sure, and I love hearing all the drama going on at Ole Miss anytime I get the chance, so I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. Talk soon.
Thanks, Ben. All right, bye.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify.
Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.